Jesus had a conversation with all of the ideas converging into the question. What is truth? Said he, and turned and walked away. What irony that he's standing in front of one who is the incarnation of truth, the embodiment of truth, and if his intention were honorable, the least he would have done is waited to hear how exactly Jesus would answer the question. Pilate raised the most important question in life, but did not wait for the answer. If we really want the truth, the Bible says when you abide in his word, you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. If somebody is truly pursuing the truth, the least they ought to do is give Jesus a hearing on what it is he says about life, its essence, and its destiny.
Good evening. How are you? Wow. My name is Mitch Barnhart. I'm the director of athletics here at the University of Kentucky. And we've had a lot of things in this building, but this is awfully special tonight. God is honored by your presence, and we thank you for being here. I just had an opportunity to speak with some folks back in the media room. We had an opportunity just to see a few folks before we started, and I wanted to sort of replicate just a couple of those thoughts out here and thank a few folks for what they've done is putting this event on. First, Christian Student Fellowship for their efforts. It's been about a year and a half, two-year journey to get this night put together, and they have worked diligently hard to do that, and so we thank them for their efforts and bringing everyone together tonight. Thank you, guys. For all the local churches that have supported this event, tremendously appreciative of that, and the people that have contributed time and money, the staff and the volunteers and the folks that have contributed to help put this evening on. We so appreciate what you have done to help this to be a very, very special night with Dr. Zacharias. My wife and I became involved with CSF about 2 years ago. We had an opportunity to go to a Thursday night event and listen to a minister from Baghdad by the name of Andrew White. It was an amazing night. And there was about 750 young people in the Christian Student Fellowship facility over on campus. And it opened our eyes to the great work they were doing on our campus. So we began to investigate a little bit about all the things they've done. Cupcakes to freshmen when they come on campus. Friday night flapjacks. Synergy on Thursday night. Shift is a freshman program on Tuesday nights. And then they have this thing called a water balloon fight, which has caused a little bit of a ruckus on campus. Just a few headlines, but great stuff. And then, oh, by the way, if you're watching the March Madness last year, a little thing called a watch party that made nighttime television famous. It was really, really good stuff. But out of all those events, what so impressed us was the fellowship that they created for so many young people on our campus. And out of that fellowship came an opportunity to share the gospel of Christ and bring people to a relationship with our Heavenly Savior. And that's special. That is most special. And about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I was up in Columbus, Ohio, and a woman asked me a question at the end of one of my talks. She said, "What keeps you up at night?" Thinking I was worried about winning and losing. And I said, "Ma'am, frankly," I said, "we're chasing a culture we can't catch." And I said, "It's moving so fast, we can't get our arms around it." And Christian Student Fellowship doesn't answer all the questions. Neither do the other ministry opportunities and groups on campus. But what they do is they provide access for young people to have an opportunity to understand some of the challenges that are going on in the world today and how you deal with that. At the end of the day, we hope that they provide an opportunity for a relationship with Christ. At the end of the day, we hope that there's peace and joy in the journey. For us, our family, we are so appreciative of the leadership for Brian Marshall and what he does with Christian Student Fellowship. And we hope that tonight sort of just is an entree to that for you all. But most of all, we hope that tonight you're honored by Dr. Zacharias' presence and all the things that he will have to say. We hope that as we leave here, that we'll continue to honor Christ in our actions, in our time, in our resources. So we thank you for being here tonight. I'm going to turn it over to Brian Marshall and let him introduce Dr. Zacharias. Brian.
You should have gotten a little thank you. You should have a card, right? Did you all get a program here? There is a card that you have that on one side it says student. On the other side, it playfully says old people. I hope the old people laugh. At 43 years old, I went to college in 1990, and I basically never left. I just kind of kept hanging around campus. And, you know, for me, when I went to college, I had just become a believer, did not grow up as a Jesus follower, but had some pivotal moments in my life that happened. And when I went to college, man, my life changed. And so in college, I was a philosophy major at a state university. You know, most of my professors that I was interacting with were not Jesus followers. And so, you know, you wrestle with a lot of challenging questions and big ideas. And it was just a huge kind of faith-shaping time for me. And so I've given my life to try to help students as they wrestle with the questions, as they ask, what's my life about? What am I here for? What am I going to do with the rest of the years I've got? And I am so pleased tonight to have Dr. Zacharias. As Mitch was saying, CSF, we host a lot of different events on campus. We host things like the world's largest water balloon fight. We host parties. We host free Friday flapjacks. We host 3 o'clock prayer where every day throughout the week, 3 o'clock, the building's open for people just to come in and pray. We host packed out worship services. We do anything and everything we can to build relationships with students in lots of fun, really fun ways. Yeah, like viewing parties where people are dancing around and just really, really fun stuff that we want to interact with. But let me just make sure that you guys understand this, is that tonight, you can cut the video or they're going to just keep watching. Thanks. Because we do a lot of fun stuff and you know, at CSF. Everything we do at CSF, we want to honor people because we have a deep belief that people are infinitely special, that our belief is that God made everyone, and that goes for people who agree with us and who say, yes, Jesus, yes, God, whatever, and it goes to people who deeply disagree with us. It doesn't matter, agree or disagree, what viewpoint they come at, they are infinitely special, and we want to honor them, whether it's just through high-fiving them at a party and just being friends, or maybe through a Bible study and showing them the ways in which God loves them. And so tonight is part of that honoring process that we honor people. And you've got a card in front of you. And I hope, if you're a student, I hope you fill that out. And you go, you know, there's some questions we're going to do. Dr. Zacharias is getting ready to come on stage in just a minute. When he's done with his talk, he and one of his colleagues, Abdu Murray, they're going to do question and answer here in front of everyone tonight and deal with some hard questions. But one of the things CSF is going to do is if you put a question down on that card tonight, we're going to send you a personal response. That's going to take us hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of work, but we're committed to honoring people's questions because, as I've heard Dr. Zacharias and other people say, it's not questions that need answering, it's people. And we want to honor the people that are here. And so if you have a question, if you're a student, we're going to try to honor you by answering those questions however we can. In fact, there's even going to be a Q&A session. We have 4 local professors, some from UK, some from some other places in the area, who are going to be right back here to the right of you all, back here answering questions afterwards. We've got a whole room set up back there. So if you don't get a question answered tonight, don't leave. Stick around and go back there and interact with some of them as well. So if you're a student, I hope you fill that out. If you're a person here who's not a student, I hope you fill out that card because you go, wow, this is incredible. I had no idea that things like this and what CSF does on campus happens and what so many of these other groups that are working on campus that are listed on the card as well, CREW, RUF, Campus Outreach, all the different groups listed on there. Man, I want to know how I can be a part of helping college students because you can. You can, wherever you're at in life. So, to the point of the night. It was almost exactly 20 years ago, someplace in the room, is a guy by the name of Pat. Pat and I met in college. We actually met arguing about baseball in a college cafeteria. And, you know, a few years later, after that argument about the Cincinnati Reds, he asked me to be best man in his wedding. He was getting married in Texas. It was 1996. Almost literally, we were within a week of the 20-year mark of his 20-year anniversary. So happy anniversary, Pat. But on that drive that I took to Texas, my mom went with me. I'd just grown up with my mom. My dad wasn't a part of my life growing up. And my mom had been diagnosed with cancer. And as we drove to Texas, lots of radio, lots of talking back and forth, I'd been given recently a set of talks that someone had recently given at Harvard, at the original Veritas Forum at Harvard University. And I said, Mom, would you care? You know, a few months later, she was going to pass away from that cancer. She lived so much longer than doctors ever gave her a chance to. It was just a really deep chance for us to wrestle and talk and to have one last road trip together. And I put that tape in. It was the days of cassette tapes, 20 years ago. And I put that tape in, and that tape was by Dr. Ravi Zacharias. And that was it hit me about a month ago, that we are exactly 20 years ago from when I first heard Ravi. And how over the years I've listened to countless Ravi talks. I've heard him speak so many different times, and I'm absolutely thrilled and honored that he is here with us tonight. I could go into all Dr. Zacharias' degrees, both earned and honored. I could tell you, you know, about all the different campuses that he's been to. In fact, this is his 30th address already in 2016. I was talking with his personal assistant, Thomas, said we'll be on the road probably 220 to 240 days this year talking, doing different meetings around the world. Ravi turns 70 next month. I don't have that much energy at 43. But he is, man, from all over the world, campuses all over the world, the United Nations, National Prayer Breakfast. Ravi is an amazing, amazing just communicator of the faith. To communicate in thoughtful ways, this is a university. You have come here to think. As a Christian, I believe you should use every ounce of your mind that God has given you. And so Dr. Zacharias is going to come help us think through some of the big questions of life here tonight. So why don't you all put your hands together and welcome to the stage, Dr. Ravi Zacharias.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Brian, and it's a real honor for me to be here in the state that made chicken famous. Especially in my country, I had friends who would get off the plane in Atlanta and want to go straight to a Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet. We're big chicken eaters in India, those who are non-vegetarians, of course, and would enjoy that, but also to be at a university that the basketball team can be so proud of. So when you combine a university, a basketball team, and chicken and all of that, it's truly a privilege to be here in Kentucky, because both goes into the stomach, goes into the head, and gives the heart some palpitations as well. So I did visit some of the restrooms that the team practices around, so that I could tell people that I have a lot in common with the Wildcats. We shared a common room. All jokes aside, but maybe one little lighthearted comment. I was telling my buddies while we were flying in here from Atlanta this morning, and the weather was quite rough, but we managed to make it, this was sent to me from India, about this guy who's going to visit a doctor, and the doctor says to him, I have a few questions for you. What kind of toothpaste do you use? And he said, I knew you use K.P. Nambudri's toothpaste. He said, what about the soap? He said, I use K.P. Nambudri's soap. He said, and the shampoo? He said, K.P. Nambudri's shampoo. He said, toothbrush? He said, K.P. Nambudri's toothbrush. So the doctor said, is this some kind of a famous international brand or what? He said, no, K.P. Nambudri is my roommate. And so I hope you and your roommate are here tonight. Being on a university campus, chances are not all of you are comfortable with the theme that is being addressed, or certainly you may not be very sympathetic to the message of the Christian faith, but you have given us the honor and courtesy of your attendance, and I'm very, very grateful that you have joined us tonight, especially if you are one who is on your journey or trying to figure out what this is really all about anyway. The themes that we cover on campuses are oftentimes given to us by people who invite us as to what would be relevant. And if we can't handle the subject on hand, we let them know. We have a team of about 47 speakers as my colleagues, placed in 15 different countries. And tonight I'm having the honor of Abdul Murray from Detroit, Michigan, joining me after I finish. He'll take a few minutes to talk to you, and then we will both field your questions. Abdu is a trained lawyer from the University of Michigan, got his law degree there. His roots go back to Lebanon, and now living, of course, in the United States. He's the author of the book, The Grand Central Question, and also one on understanding the critical analysis of various worldviews. So he'll join me later, and after I finish my talk, he'll take a few minutes and we will field your questions. I don't think it is questionable at all, but that we are living in very, very critical times. And I don't mean this to be a political statement, although it's a slanted comment on it. When I go overseas, as we cover a lot of countries, within about 10 days, I'll be doing a few campuses in India. And I have absolutely no doubt several of them are going to come up to me and say, what is going on in the American political arena? As they watch the debates, as they watch the vitriol, as they watch all kinds of strong language being used and personal attacks being made, rather than ideas being questioned and challenged. We recognize full well that this is a time of crises on the global scene. Many years ago, I was in Syria, about 5-6 years ago, and I was a guest of the chief of intelligence in Damascus. They always called me in whenever I arrived to remind me not to get into the political turmoil of that part of the world. And I always gave them my word. But I looked at the chief of intelligence, surrounded by the military brass, and I said to him, I don't get into the politics of the region, sir, but it would be very helpful to me if you can briefly tell me, what do you think is going on in this part of the world? I want you to know this was before anything like ISIS, any of the crises that had erupted, before the Arab Spring, and so on. And his answer to me shocked me because it was made in a statement or two. He said, Mr. Zacharias, if things do not change here within the next 5 years, this whole place is going to blow up. If things don't change here within the next 5 years or so, this whole place is going to blow up. And how do you come back with another question on that? The fact of the matter is that there is an incredible uncertainty as weapons of destruction pile up, and those controlling some of those weapons come from backdrops and political structures where they are more demagogically controlled than the will of the people or some ethical underpinning that drives their passions. And so I want to begin with two comments and then lead into a basic backdrop against which I want to address these issues of the four major questions of life. It was in the 1970s, I believe, that Malcolm Muggeridge, that prolific writer, made this comment. He said, it is difficult to resist the conclusion that 20th century man has decided to abolish himself. Tired of the struggle to be himself, he has created boredom out of his own affluence, impotence out of his own erotomania, and vulnerability out of his own strength. He himself blows the trumpet that brings the walls of his own cities crashing down until at last, having educated himself into imbecility, having drugged and polluted himself into stupefaction, he keels over a weary, battered old brontosaurus and becomes extinct. Now, the fascinating thing about Muggeridge is that as a journalist and as one who described himself as being fatally fluent, lived an indulgent life, was a latecomer to Christ, also a chaplain of the University of Edinburgh, resigned his position from the chaplaincy when he saw the trend of where education was going, and on the basis of all of that, talked about how we'd created boredom out of our own affluence, impotence out of our own erotomania, vulnerability out of our own strength, and how this weary, battered old brontosaurus keels over and becomes extinct. About a few years before he said that, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. received the Nobel Prize for Peace. And here was a man who was so articulate and so precise in what he said and impassioned in what he believed. Listen to these words in his speech. I accept this award today with an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in a river of life. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of thermonuclear destruction. Now here's the line. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. So to you as young, bright minds in one of the finest universities of the world, I have this question to you. If our entire educational ethos is built on naturalism and a scientific single vision of ultimate reality, which discipline in that framework gives to you the imperatives of unarmed truth and unconditional love? These are philosophical principles. This is not given to us by the exact sciences. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. What of the exact sciences gives you this eternal oughtness that forever confronts us? And so I say to you, whatever world you will live in, and it, you know, when you're sitting down and somebody introduces you and says, you know what, next month he's going to turn 70, you say, my word, I didn't know that myself. But it's true. The calendar does not lie. And we are reminded again and again of, as each passing year comes and goes, that the world is changing at a staggering pace. I have no idea what kind of world will be yours 10 to 15 years from now, but I'm hoping it is the kind of world that Dr. King talked about, the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood. What a glorious thing it would be to have unarmed truth and unconditional love, because truth is the most powerful weapon in the world and love is the most supreme ethic in the world. Where do we find these? Philosopher who lived between 1844 and 1900 was the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. His father was a pastor. Both of his grandfathers were pastors. But somewhere he clenched his fist at God and philosophically believed it could no longer be sustained. And he wrote this parable. You will recognize it. I will read it for you in extenso, a few paragraphs, because on this I want to build my deductions. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God. As many of those who did not believe in God were standing together there, he excited considerable laughter. Have you lost him, said one. Did he lose his way like a child, said another. Maybe God is hiding. Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or emigrated? So they shouted and shouted and laughed him to scorn. But the madman sprang into their midst and pierced them with his glances. Where is God? He cried. I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all suns, maybe? Are we not perpetually falling forwards, backwards, sidewards, in all directions? Do you notice the metaphors he's using here? They are poignant. Are we not perpetually falling backwards, forwards, sidewards? Is there any up or down left? Are we not strained through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not suddenly become colder? Is not more and more night coming on us all the time? Must not lanterns now have to be lit in the morning hours? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? God's decomposed too, you know, and he's dead. He remains dead, and we killed him. Now, how shall we, the murderer of all murderers, compose ourselves? Because that which was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet possessed has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood from us? With what water should we purify ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games will we need to invent? Is this not the greatest of deeds? Too great for us to handle. Must not we now ourselves become God simply to seem worthy of it? There's never been a greater deed, you know, and whoever shall be born after us for the sake of this deed shall be part of a different history than all history hitherto. This tremendous event is still on its way, still traveling, and has not yet reached the ears of men. The madman fell silent and regarded his listeners. They too were silent. They stared at him in astonishment. He threw his lantern to the ground and it broke, and he went out. I come too early. Maybe my time has not yet come. It has been related further on the same day that the madman entered diverse churches and there sang a requiem, Eternum Deo. Led out and quieted, he is said to have retorted each time, what are these churches now if they are not the tombs on the sepulchres of God? God is dead. We have killed him. I remember taking some courses with the famed Don Cupid, who was professor at Emmanuel College, Cambridge University. He was an Anglican priest turned atheist. And I remember on more than one occasion, he would walk up to the window and point to the school opposite and the spires of a church. And he said, this was all our heritage at one time. It's gone. We no longer can believe any of this. Ironically, a few miles down the road was John Polkinghorne, one of the leading quantum physicists, who was a latecomer to Christ, in whose lectures he would be arguing for the rationality and the defense of God's existence. And so the worldviews collide. If you take Nietzsche's words, then I have four unanswered questions that will bring coherence to your life and mine. The first is this: where do we find our moral framework? Where do we find a moral law? If naturalism is completely in control, if materialism is all that there is, and there is no absolute, remember what Nietzsche said, there is no up and down. There is no up and down. And so if you listen to politics, it's right or left. There is no up and down. They don't believe in the vertical, transcendent notion anymore. Will lanterns have to be lit in the morning hours? What sacred games will we need to invent? Are we not perpetually falling? As Chesterton said, there's only one angle at which you can stand straight and many, many angles at which you can fall. Chesterton went on to say, the tragedy of disbelieving in God is not that you end up believing in nothing. Alas, it is much worse. You may end up believing in anything. And we're testing the angles now. Where is there a moral law? The irony of this is as follows. Adolf Hitler took the Nietzschean phrase of a higher history, took the writings of Nietzsche, personally presented Nietzsche's writings to Stalin and Mussolini, and between these three created a kind of a hell in this world. And I've given the illustration so many times, but I never tire of it, because we are always not far away from being forced to repeat the same mistakes. It was in the 1980s, during the Cold War, when I happened to be visiting Poland and Russia. I'd never been to those parts of the world before. And my host in Warsaw took me one day to visit the concentration camp of Auschwitz. I had been to Buchenwald and Dachau and some of the other camps, but they were not death camps, so emotionally I was not prepared for it. And when you walk into Auschwitz, the only thing you hear in those confines, I kid you not, is silence. You don't hear anything. Probably, if I'm being brutally specific with it, the one thing I did hear was a young gal storming out of there and then bursting into sobs and going outside to sit in the front veranda of that building. And when we walked out, I still saw her sitting there holding her face in her hands. She was a young woman. She saw what had happened. You see, at Auschwitz alone, they were obliterating them at 12,000 every day. And Eichmann's comment was that the first time he saw what happened and got the report of a whole lot of them being herded into the gas ovens, denuded, shaven, the head shaven off, and leaning flesh against flesh, already emaciated, they were told they were going into the showers. And when they would be taken into that room and the gas spigots would be turned on, they would only be able to hear one or two people screaming out, "Gas!" And that's all they would hear. And the bodies were literally shoveled out. Eichmann said, as painful as it was the first time, I learned we were now able to disperse of many, many bodies at the same time and do it in the quickest possible way. He said, one death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. But just outside the gas ovens were the words of Hitler. I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperial, relentless, and cruel. What they did with kids there, what they did with womankind there, as many people were dragged into this onslaught who didn't want to be dragged in, who never realized what they were going into. When I wrote a book called Jesus Talks to Hitler in a Great Conversation series, I went to Nuremberg with one of my colleagues who's an authority on that to help me with my research. The first thing that struck me in the judgment hall at Nuremberg, just above the tribunal, were the Ten Commandments. And as you leave the hall, above the door, or I forget, above or beside it, was the Garden of Eden and the temptation, "You shall be as gods, knowing good and evil," meaning defining good and evil. So here was the challenge. Were they going to let God be God, or were they going to become definers of good and evil? Now, the important thing to state here is to understand what I am not saying. I am not saying for a moment that an atheist, by definition, is an evil person, a mass murderer, this and that. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just wanting to point out that once you do away with the absolute, once you do away with the existence of God, where do you turn for your absolutes? Where do you turn? How do we get an answer? Probably the most recent work of Sam Harris made a noble effort at trying to talk about the moral landscape. And of course, he transposed positions from talking about morality to well-being. And then he himself concedes towards the end that, yes, we have a lot of psychopaths in the country, about 3 million of them, and a person can be a mass murderer and still be extremely happy. And in a puzzling conclusion, then ends up not really with an absolute, but some kind of a continuum. And so the man today who stands in front of the lens of a camera and uses a sword without even having the courage for his or her face to be seen to behead somebody can also say to you and to me, he is doing this for geopolitical well-being. It's exactly what they believe. I have sat across tables and discussed, dialogued, and asked such questions. And I say the discussion, even amongst philosophers, is a divided house. Kai Nielsen, the renowned atheist from Calgary, we have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that really rational persons, unhoodwinked by myth or ideology, need not be individual egoists or classical amoralists. Reason doesn't decide here. The picture I have painted for you is really not a pleasant one. Reflection on this actually depresses me. Pure, practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to to morality. This is a very outspoken atheist. He says this, even with a good knowledge of the facts, it will not take you to morality. Richard Rorty, if moral imperatives are not commanded by God's will, and if they are not in some sense absolute, then what we wish to be is a matter simply of what men and women decide should be. There is no other source of judgment. Two renowned atheists, Bertrand Russell says, you know what? I cannot live as though ethical values were simply a matter of personal taste, but I find my own views incredible. I do not know what the real solution is. There has to be a rational justification above all of our differences. And this is especially important for America at this time in her history, where pluralism is a design, and it is a good design. I happen to be a privileged one who was born in one part of the world, at the age of 20 moved to the other part of the world, and because the doors of these nations were open with a legitimate pluralism, people like me could come here, earn a living, raise our families. But the absolutes that built this nation are now in serious jeopardy, and we had better realize it. The absolutes that built this nation, because the nation talked about the fact that there were naturally endowed rights given to us, that these truths were self-evident. All of these moral statements are very critical to understand in the light of our pluralistic culture in our time. I know by going to places in the world right now, people look at me and will ask the question, what is going on in the West? What is going on? Was it not Adolf Eichmann who finally, when he was tried in Israel and was sentenced to the death penalty, I was there when they were dealing with all of the evidence and was given several pages and pages of the trial, which I was able to get back before I wrote my book. But here's Hannah Arendt describing Eichmann's last moment. This is critical, and I move to my next thought here. Adolf Eichmann went to the gallows with great dignity. He'd asked for a bottle of red wine and drank half of it. He refused the help of a Protestant minister, the Reverend William Hull, who offered to read the Bible with him. He had only 2 more hours to live, and therefore he said, good, quote, I have no time to waste. He walked the 50 yards from his cell to the execution chamber, calm and erect, with his hands bound behind him. When the guards tied his ankles and knees, he asked them to loosen the bonds so that he could stand straight. I don't need that, he said. When the black hood was offered to him, he was in complete command of himself. Nay, he was more than that. He was completely himself. Nothing could have demonstrated this more convincingly than the grotesque silliness of his last words. He began by stating emphatically that he was a Gottgläubiger, to express in Nazi fashion that he was no Christian and did not believe in life after death. He then proceeded, quote, after a short while, gentlemen, we shall all meet again. Such is the fate of all men. Long live Germany, long live Argentina, long live Austria. I shall not forget them. In the face of death, he had found the cliché used in funeral oratory. Under the gallows, his memory played in the last trick. He was elated, and he forgot that this was really his own funeral. It was as though in those last minutes he was summing up the lesson. I want you to hear this now. It was as though in those last minutes he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness has taught us, the lesson of the fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil. Evil had become trivial. The man who arrested Eichmann in a cloak and dagger operation in Argentina tells the story, he's now long gone, but he tells the story that he was bringing him back. If you've read the book, the House on Garibaldi Street, you know exactly how they got him. They waylaid him, they stalked him, ultimately put an injection into him and knocked him out and brought him up under a different name in a plane. The Mossad had done its work to bring him back. And the man who brought him back looked at him, sat down next to him in the train, and he broke his own code. He wasn't supposed to talk to him. But he couldn't resist this. He said, Mr. Eichmann, I have a question for you. Every day I watched you from a distance. I saw you getting off the bus, looking over your shoulder, carrying your briefcase there in that little town in Argentina. Just before you entered your own home, you would turn around to make sure nobody was watching. I was watching you, sir, from a distance, behind the bushes. I was watching you. But I noticed something, Mr. Reichman. Every day, as you opened the door, there was a young boy who was waiting for you and leaped into your arms. Who was that boy? He said, he was my son. He said, Mr. Reichman, how old is your son? He said, 8. He said, you killed my nephew who was 8. Can you tell me what was the difference? And Peter Malkin, with the Israeli Mossad, was sitting by his bed waiting for the answer, and Eichmann turned to him and said, Peter, my son was not Jewish. Malkin said, he got up from there and walked away and sobbed with uncontrollable tears. He never wanted to see this man again. The bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood had not yet become a reality. Where are we going to turn from moral law? Where am I going to find your value and my value? If you don't have essential value, we are dependent upon the state to give us value. You know, Moses gave the people 613 laws. David reduced it to 15. Isaiah reduced it to 11. When Jesus was on the earth, they asked him, which is the greatest commandment? Jesus could have very easily said one. He didn't. He said that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. He said, on these two commandments hang all of the laws and the prophets, that you and I are made imago Dei, the image of God, is a unique truth to the Judeo-Christian worldview. In the same chapter in the Bible, there's a conversation between a man who comes to Jesus and said, is it all right to pay taxes to Caesar? How wonderful it would have been if Jesus had said no. Jesus said, do you have a coin? The man said, yes. He said, give it to me. He held the coin out to him and he said, whose image is on this? The man said, Caesar. He said, give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and give to God that which belongs to God. The man should have had a follow-up question. The follow-up question should have been, what belongs to God? And Jesus would have said, whose image is on you? Whose image is on you? This is what gives you your unique essential worth. In a moral framework that moves horizontally, without moving vertically, there is no essential worth. There is no eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. I have no right to violate you as an individual. I have no right to violate your property. I have no right to invade your life because you are made in the image of God. You have a right to make your choices. I have no right to stand in the way of your choices either. But the choices will always have consequences. And so what I say to you is, God gives you the greatest compliment in telling you you're made imago Dei. And Jesus Christ takes that so specifically. He says to you that your body and mine are the temple of the living God. We don't go to the temple. We take the temple with us. This is inviolable. The moral law that Martin Luther King talks about, the eternal oughtness. And you know, people often say, yes, he was very much inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, which is true. Mahatma Gandhi's life in ahimsa, nonviolence, had a lot of an inspiration. But let me tell you two things about that. Mahatma Gandhi would never have used the term unconditional love, because that is very much from the Judeo-Christian worldview. And Gandhiji carried a New Testament wherever he went and often would quote from the Sermon on the Mount. And it is fascinating that in one of Gandhi's homes in India is a quote by Bertrand Russell. And outside that home, the banner says this: it is doubtful that the Mahatma would have succeeded in his effort except that he was appealing to people with a Christianized conscience. So here was an atheist, a applauding the success of a pantheist because of appealing to the conscience of a theist. You see how important it is to understand that a moral law has to have this transcendent value. But secondly and quickly, not only is the question of a moral law unanswerable from a horizontal perspective, Guy Nielsen sustains that. Even J.L. Mackey argues for the struggle. You've got several atheists who deal, Michael Ruse deals with the same issue, Richard Rorty. They all bring up the question of where do we go for an absolute objective moral law? But the second question is that of meaning. How do I really find meaning in my life? Recently, I had the privilege of speaking at a conference called Passion. Some of you are out here who are at that conference. 40,000 in a live audience in three venues and tens of thousands scattered across listening in from about 115 different universities in 47 countries, 18 to 24 or so at age bracket. Many of those who went forward to find help, do you know what were the two most important issues in their lives for which they sought help, 18 to 24? Number one was among the young guys, especially struggling with pornography. And number two was the stalking, haunting fear of suicide. I don't know if they ever saw the logical connection. Pornography denudes the other person. It doesn't just disrobe, denudes the other person in exchange for a feeling. The person who's hooked by it is not looking for a person. The person who's hooked by it is looking for a feeling ultimately that no one person in the world can satisfy. And once you have robbed the other person of any value, you ultimately denude your own self, and there is no purpose and meaning found. Now, that logical connection wasn't there in my life, but the end result still was. I came to know Christ on a bed of suicide when I was 17 years old in Delhi because I had no meaning in my life. I didn't care what anybody was saying to me. It all didn't add up. It simply didn't make sense. People say, what does meaning really mean? It's a long talk one can give on its own, but let me just tell you, meaning is found with four components. A sense of wonder. We watch children reading fairy tales and being read to in fairy tales, and the enchantment is awesome. They want this sense of wonder. But as they grow up, they begin to struggle, and they say the fairy tales are not true. They were merely fantastic. They were mere fantasy. Now they're looking for that which is fantastically true. Wonder, truth. Thirdly, the experience of love. And finally, the knowledge of security. If you're really looking for meaning to build a coherent worldview, you're going to have these four components: wonder, truth, love, and security. I will deal with just one of them as I bring my message to a close. But here it is, this sense of a moral law that we cannot find, the quest for meaning that we hunger after. Let me give you an illustration of this. One existentialist writer wrote a play a long time ago called The Adulterous Woman. A woman who had just wanted to flirt with all this kind of stuff, but she had held back and never indulged in it. So her husband takes her into a town where he's dealing with his works and jewelry and all of that. At the end of it, he comes back exhausted and he is in bed. And the woman thinks to herself, everything I saw in town, tonight's my night to have a last fling. I will never have it again. And he's sound asleep. She wakes up, gets dressed, goes out into the night, and expends herself in ways she had never, ever dreamed. She spent herself into pleasure and exhausted with pleasure. She comes back in the early hours of the morning, opens the door while he is still sound asleep. She slips under the covers, but there's a big problem. She cannot fall asleep now. On her pillow, the tears are rolling down the side of the face. And her husband hears the sobs and wakes up and looks at her and said, what's the matter? She brushes him aside and says, nothing, just nothing. See, the loneliest moment is when you have just experienced that which promised you the ultimate and it has let you down. The loneliest moment is when you've just experienced that which has promised you the ultimate and it has let you down. I look at you tonight as young students and I say, and you're really the primary reason I'm here, by the way, because I care for the student world. I care for the young life that is living today, almost skidding out of control with no answers. The meaning that Christ offers to you is a meaning in a personal relationship. Justice Antonin Scalia just passed away last week, and some of the channels were playing some of his major speeches. He was considered one of the brightest intellectuals on the Supreme Court bench. Whether you agreed with him or not is not the issue here. Even those who disagreed with him were good friends and said the man was made of sterling character. And in his speech, I was just puttering around the house and I heard him make three statements back to back. And I thought, what on earth is this about? He was behind the lectern. He said, I want you all to hear me. He said, sophisticated thinkers can believe in God. That's what he said. Next statement, sophisticated thinkers can believe in a personal God. Third statement he made, sophisticated thinkers can believe in the person of Jesus Christ, the very Son of God. And meaning comes ultimately in finding the sacred that binds the diversity of your proclivities and gives it that homogeneity of a supreme expression that is bound by the skin of the sacred. The sacred is what gives life meaning. So you know where the boundaries are. You know where the purpose is. Moral law, unanswered. Where do we find the sacred? And if we don't find the sacred, we have no meaning. Where are the answers? Thirdly, and quickly, I say to you, what about hope? Where is hope really found if life ends in the grave? One of my great privileges is to speak to our military bases. I'll be doing two or three of them this year. I've always gone there to minister to our men and women in the armed forces. Whenever it is finished, they always line up and will talk to me, to have a word of prayer, and talk about the dangers with which they live. I was led into this when I was 25 years old, speaking in Vietnam. I was a young undergraduate student, invited to speak in Vietnam, going from military base to military base. And I saw death on the side of the highways. I saw death as we flew in the choppers all around, going from one venue to another. I saw death and dying in military hospitals, where in some places, unless you had a burn on your body, there were two bodies to each bed. And when I saw the horrors of that kind of warfare, I said, what are we doing to our fellow human beings? And yet these are the very ones who look for hunger and look for hope. I was just meeting a gentleman from Egypt before we came in here. My colleagues and I were in Egypt in November, and one night we spoke to a large number of young people. On that given night alone in Cairo, over 500 young men and women responded to the invitation to follow Jesus Christ. Their life had been empty. They realized the moment had come to see what it is that Christ offered to them. And before I move to my final thought, I had a dialogue with Sheikh Hussein, the leading Shia cleric in Syria. He sat from the table there with an interpreter, always kept addressing me as professor, even though I told him I wasn't a professor. But he kept respectfully calling me Professor Zacharias, Professor Zacharias. He would ask me a question about my faith, I would answer him. I would ask him a question about his faith, he would answer me. What a marvelous moment of a few moments they were to dialogue cordially with somebody of a different worldview. And people listening to this for nearly 3 hours. When it was over, he leaned forward and said something through the interpreter. I said, what did he say? He said, Mr. Zacharias, maybe it's time for me and my people who follow a different faith to stop asking if Jesus died on the cross and to start asking why. I said, Sheikh Hussein, may I quote you on that, sir? He said, yes, you may. You have to ask yourself the question, in the gospel narrative, the cross is central. Why? Because your greatest need is not for a political leader. Your greatest need is not for the best of education. All of those are important. But your need and my need, the greatest need we have, is deep within our own heart, where evil stalks and seeks to take over. Our greatest need is for a Savior. Our greatest need is for a Savior. No moral law, no meaning, no hope. And lastly, I say, the supremacy of the ethic of love. The supremacy of the ethic of love. Think of this. Where do we go to understand love? Would you allow me just a personal illustration of this? You know, Winston Churchill was once asked by a corporal, "Mr. Churchill, have I ever talked to you about my grandchildren?" Churchill said, "No, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it." So I won't bore you with my grandchildren's stories, but since I'm not Churchill, can I tell you at least one? I have a 4-year-old grandson. His name is Jude. I don't know where he gets his vocabulary from. I really don't. One day he leans over at the dinner table a few months ago and he says, "Papa, what is the meaning of sophomoric?" I told my daughter, "You better watch this guy. If he's using the word sophomoric, which I didn't even understand till I was in my 20s and was probably very sophomoric in my behavior at that time." But one day his mother, when he was about just a little over 3, his mother had lost her car keys. And she's looking around the house and can't find it. And she slapped her forehead and said, "I must be losing my mind." Jude comes over in front of her, looks her in the eye and says, "Mommy, whatever you do, please don't ever lose your heart, because I'm in there." And I ask you, where did that intuitive statement come to him from? Where did that statement come to him from? See, the longing for love is very real in your life and mine. But we only think of romantic love, or we only think of other loves. In the Greek language, there are 4 loves: agape, storge, phileo, and eros. Storge, protective love; phileo, friendship love; eros, romantic love. It all hangs on agape, which is God's love. If you lose God's love, you cannot define the other 3. And so the love that you and I long for, that binds it all together for you and me, which is something that, by the way, Bertrand Russell himself said he never found in life. And when I go from place to place in this world to preach the love of Christ, I think of this and I close with this. In John 3:16, the Bible says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life." About 25 words, depending on which exact translation you use. About 25 words. What do you have in all of that? You have that which is causal. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. You have that which is filial. You have that which is sacrificial. You have that which is relational. You have that which is eternal. And it is all bound up in the judicial. It is all bound up in the judicial. Causal, filial, relational, eternal, sacrificial, all bound up in the judicial. We say we are a country of laws. I say to you, God is the one in whom there is no contradiction, and the moral law is an intrinsic part of his character. Everything in love, everything in sacrifice, everything in relationship, everything that he offers to you and me is built within the legal framework of God's being, in whom there is no contradiction. Where there is contradiction, there is breakdown. So in these 4 issues alone, of law, meaning, hope, and love, they are the unanswered questions of naturalism. There is no objective source of defining them. In the Judeo-Christian worldview, they correspond to reality in measuring it. They cohere in a worldview. And so I present to you that option as worthy
of your investigation. That's why Jesus said, I am come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. We'll have a chance to take your questions. May God richly bless you. Thank you for giving me a hearing. I stand next to him, I fail the physical. I remember hugging my wife once, giving her the best possible hug, and she looked at me, pushed her face back, and said, she has a loving name for me, I won't tell you what it is. But she said to me, I just want you to know you have the arms of a thinking man. So I'm working on becoming a non-thinking man. But I'm really glad to have the arms of a thinking man here, too. This is Abdul Murray. He's going to share a few thoughts with you. Please welcome him from Detroit, Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. What a blessing and an honor, and a daunting task, by the way, to follow the comments of a truly thinking man. My name is Abdul Murray, and I'll be joining Ravi for some Q&A. Following just some very brief comments. If you've noticed, there's a bit of an oddity in my name, and one of the first questions I get, speaking of Q&A, is what's with the Abdu and what's with the Murray? Lebanese and Scottish? How does that work? The short story is that basically it got anglicized when we came over. You can't really write my last name or even say it in English letters necessarily, so they said, okay, your last name is Murray. So I'm Lebanese and Scottish, which means that I fight with everybody. I hope not today, actually, that won't be the case. We want to come to you in the spirit of answering your questions with a real sense of we can disagree or we can agree, but we don't necessarily have to be disagreeable about these things. Now, as we come to you talking about these questions, and you're going to have some very profound questions over the course of the evening, generated, I hope, by Dr. Zacharias' talk and some of the things you've heard. I want to ask you a question, and it's a question that neither I nor Ravi, nor anybody else can answer, I should say. The question is this: why are you here? Why are you here? There's a lot of you here, and everyone has an individual reason why you're here. Now, perhaps you're somebody from a strong Christian faith, and you've come to hear how a defense of the Christian faith can go, someone who can provide answers to these things. Maybe you've been posed a difficult question that you can't find the answer to, or you've struggled to articulate it. You're, of course, welcome. Maybe you're someone who's come from a Christian home, who has a strong Christian faith, or who had it, at least at one point, but because of the way in which the worldviews have come at you, and you've had these questions posed to you, and you don't know how to answer those questions, maybe your faith is teetering on the edge of ruin. It's a great place for you to be. Maybe you're somebody from a contrary worldview, somebody who was not raised in a Christian home, or was, and is now finds themselves to be an atheist, or maybe you're from a pantheistic background, or you're a Muslim. This is for you as well. By the way, you're someone with whom I most identify in this room, because I came from a worldview that was not a Christian worldview. I was raised most of my life from a counter worldview to Christianity. I was raised as a Muslim, a committed Muslim, and I took it seriously. In fact, friends, I would actually challenge my Christian friends about their worldview. You see, I had this fundamental belief in God's greatness. As a Muslim, we believe in the Muslims believe in this phrase, content of this phrase, Allahu Akbar. You've all heard this phrase. If you've watched the news for 5 seconds, you've heard someone say Allahu Akbar. And unfortunately, when you hear it, something bad happens. But the reality is this, friends, that oftentimes, Muslims say this all the time in nonviolent ways. It's not really a battle cry always. It's a blessing. It literally means God is greater. The fundamental doctrines of Islam, and for me especially, was God's greatness. How do we understand God to be truly great? It literally means God is greater. So for the Muslim, there is no being who is greater than God. And I firmly believed that. I also believed in those days that Christians wished they believed in a God who was great, but they were really confused tritheists. They thought they were monotheists, but they were confused tritheists, whatever it would be. And I would challenge them on their faith. And I would say, I hear this, you know, this hymn you sing, how great thou art, you ought to change it to how great thou art not. And I would go into it, challenging the Trinity, the Incarnation, the Atonement, and the Bible itself in terms of its validity. But a funny thing happened in the way of the mosque, as they say. I was confronted with the credibility of the Christian faith. By the way, I was an equal opportunity faith knocker outer ever. It wasn't just Christians I was looking at. There were people from contrary worldviews, whether atheist or Hindu or Buddhist, whatever it was. But Christians were low-hanging fruit in the area I grew up in. But they began to respond to me and to say, you know, if this is actually something you might want to think about, the validity of the Bible, for example, and how we have it transmitted down through the centuries as something that is reliable and gives me a source for the historic Christian faith, for the theologies behind it, that the Trinity actually makes some kind of sense. And in fact, it makes supreme sense if you're looking for a God who is truly great. That the atonement, the incarnation of God in Christ and what happened at Calvary's Hill actually can satisfy not only the heart, but also the mind. And of course, the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus himself. These things started to build up, and they were becoming what Al Gore would call an inconvenient truth in my life. You see, I didn't want them to be true because that would mean that I'd have to change my perspective, my worldview. And if we know something, and I think everybody in this room knows this, you know that if you hold a worldview dearly, there's a certain level of clinging to that worldview because a worldview actually comes into play into your identity. And so if you change that worldview, you change something about who you are. It's a tough thing to do. And friends, it took 9 years as that inconvenient truth became more and more true, but also more and more inconvenient because of the identity shift that would have to happen in my own life. 9 years of searching, of asking questions, of debating, of getting questions answered, and then rehashing them over and over again. But I began to see that this worldview is worth at least considering. All of us, no matter what your stripe is, from a secular background, from a theistic background, from whatever it might be, we all face this. Think of the words of Thomas Nagel, the famous philosopher, atheistic philosopher out of New York University, when he says, "I want atheism to be true, and I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It's not that I disbelieve in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my beliefs. It's that I don't want there to be a God. I hope there is no God. I don't want the universe to be like that." That's a very honest statement. Not about the lack of evidence in favor of God, but about the desire that there be none. We all face these things. Every one of us. You see, the issue is this, and I found this over that course of that 9 years. The answers are not all that hard to find. They're not all that hard to find. They're not even all that hard to agree upon intellectually. But they can be very hard to accept. Because it requires each one of us to change something about ourselves. You know, C.S. Lewis made the statement, if you look for comfort, he said, if you look for truth, you will find comfort. But if you look for comfort, you will get neither truth nor comfort, only soft soap to begin with, and in the end, despair. It's very important you hear what he's saying here. He's saying, if you look for truth, you will find comfort in the end. But if you look for comfort primarily, you will get neither. Only a soft soap to begin with, but in the end, there will be a despair. Because truth has a way of catching up to us. But we want to sort of serve that comfort. I certainly wanted to. I can tell you this, I identify with that. I wanted desperately for the Christian worldview to not be true, especially the gospel of Jesus and him dying on a cross. You see, I thought that if I believed in a God who is great, how could it be that the God of the universe, the God of all creation, could become incarnate in a limited body and die on a cross at the very hands of the sinners he created? How is this God great exactly? But then I realized something. And Dr. Zacharias mentioned it about the whole supreme ethic of love. Think about this. In Islam, you do have a God who is loving. It's a conditional love, but it is there. But he would be supremely that way. If God is the greatest possible being, then he would express the greatest possible ethic, which is love, in the greatest possible way. And what is the greatest possible way that is possible to express love in? Sending books for us to follow? Rules? Regulations? These might be acts of love, but they're not the supreme act of love. The greatest possible way to express the greatest possible ethic is self-sacrifice. And if you and I are capable of doing that, ought not the God of the universe, the greatest possible being, be able to do that himself? And the cross of Christ, the historic cross of Christ, and that empty tomb proved he did it. So as we begin to ask ourselves these questions, we welcome your questions. We come from a particular worldview and a particular idea and perspective about how we want to answer your questions. I have to ask you the question, and you have to ask yourself this question. Why are you here? Why do you have the question you ask? Because each one of you asks a question, not in an academic sense purely out of curiosity. That is there. But also, you are a unique individual with a unique history and a future you worry about. And so your questions are always tied to the person. You've heard something of Ravi's story about how he came to faith and the tremendous price that was, when he was looking for comfort, he didn't find it, but then found it when he found truth. You've heard a little snippet of my own story. But as I close, I want to say this from C.S. Lewis, who called himself the most reluctant convert in all of England. That from the Christian perspective, we embrace this idea of experiencing the cost of truth, because the one who we claim is the very embodiment of truth experiences the price himself. Lewis said, "The great thing to remember is that though our feelings come and go, his love for us does not. It is not wearied by our sins or our indifference, and therefore it is quite relentless in its determination that we shall be cured of those sins at whatever cost to us." At whatever cost to him, it is a self-sacrificial God that I found as the search that my heart was longing for and my mind was longing for as well. I'll close with this. As Brian comes up and leads us in the question and answer period, in Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, the Apostle Paul says that we are to be careful how we walk toward outsiders, meaning non-Christians, walking in wisdom. At the end of it, he says this: we ought to know how we ought to answer each person, not each question, not each objection, not each argument, not each issue. Because people need answers. People look for answers. Questions don't need answers. People do. People have questions in order to get those answers. It's my prayer that as Brian comes up and we take your questions, as you come forward to ask those questions, that it is not just your questions that are being asked and answered, but that you feel respected by us, and that it is you who are being answered. Thank you so much.
So here's what we want to do. We have a microphone that we are setting up just down here. One of the even the things that I know Abdu and Dr. Zacharias appreciate is just the ability to even look a questioner in the eye and to try to honor them with just a face-to-face interaction. And so if you have a question here tonight, you go, I just need this answer. And in particular, tonight, as Ravi said, is, you know, we are so glad for so many people from the community to be a part of tonight, but tonight is primarily about students. And to give students a chance, as many ideas are shared on a university campus that would be in conflict with what's been shared here tonight, to give students a chance. And so if you're a student here and you go, I have a question I want to ask, and in particular, if you're somebody who's going, I'm someplace along the journey, I don't even know where I'm at along the journey, but I've got a question that needs to be asked. We want to give you a chance and invite you to come up and to ask a question at the microphone. So if you have a question, you want to start making your way up here, we want to take any question, honor any questioner that we have here in the center tonight. So go ahead and feel free to make your way there. If you are maybe a little bit shy and you go, there's a lot of people here and I feel nervous, we understand that as well. We have a slide up here. If you have your phone available as well, you can do this. I really want to encourage you to take the opportunity even now. We won't have time to take all the questions here tonight. We'll have space for Q&A afterwards. But to find a space there to line up. But if you go, I have a phone, and you want to text in or tweet in, I think we've got a slide up here actually above my head here. Submit your questions. You can tweet a question in to UKYRavi. You can use that hashtag on Twitter. You can also, if you want to text, that is the CSF cell phone, which I'm pretty sure will explode. So if you hear something, don't be alarmed. It's just a cell phone going boom. But you can text in a question as well if you have one there or you want to tweet that in. So if you have somebody here, I know there's a lot of people here. We want to honor any questions that you have. So we have an open mic, and I know a lot of people have some questions. So if you have anything you want to ask, feel free to make your way over. Yes, please. What's your question there for Dr. Zacharias or Abdu Murray?
Well, Michael, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight and spending time here. My question is, when debating atheists like Stephen Hawking and other people like that. What is the, how do you convince someone like him that God exists without using the Bible necessarily?
Well, I was having lunch with Stephen Hawking yesterday. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure your question is not specific, but we get the idea. I spent 6 months at Ridley Hall in Cambridge and actually heard one or two lectures from him, one a very famous lecture from him at Lady Mitchell Hall in 1990, and he was addressing the issue of are we determined or are we free? And, of course, Hawking is considered the, if not the brightest, one of the brightest minds in the world of science today, which is very amazing to me. He can't speak because of Lou Gehrig's disease. He has this computer designed by a Caltech scientist, and either by the cutting into the infrared ray with his eyelid or with a movement of finger, he's able to select letters, texts, and so on. And it's amazing that he... So it takes him very long to even answer a question. That's why you can ask very difficult questions, and it'll take him about 2 or 3 minutes to compute his answer, and his answer always is very brief. But you know, the interesting thing is, if naturalism was the only worldview reigning, I wonder if Stephen Hawking would have made it this far. A scientist gave him the equipment by which he could communicate, but it was love, compassion, altruism, and generosity that cared for him and brought him through all of those years. So there were philosophical ideas behind it that protected his life. In his brief history of time, the last page, he makes something like this. He said, "Now I have told you what, if I could tell you why, we would have the mind of God." Very interesting that he gave that little caveat, and at that time he was attending one or two churches in the area on the weekend, and somebody told me who knew him that he was on his own spiritual search. But of course, in his later book, The Grand Design, he talked about the fact that gravity explains everything, and he made the very irrational and unfortunate statement that philosophy is dead. So much so, theologians did not respond to him. The chairman of the philosophy department at Cambridge responded by saying, "Maybe it's about time the oracular Professor Hawking recognized that he's not kept up with our discipline as much as we have with his," and this kind of hostility developed. But as I told you, down the road was John Polkinghorne, the quantum physicist, who, of course, knows Stephen Hawking. I don't know what the answer is, how one leads him, but the answer to your specific question, how do you do it without invoking the Bible, is really not that difficult. Because his explanation that gravity is really at the heart of it and explains everything is like me explaining a dictionary because of the alphabet. It doesn't follow. The alphabet exists, but the compilation requires design and specified complexity. It is a rather simplistic explanation to say gravity explains it all. And our colleague from Oxford, John Lennox, responded to Stephen Hawking in one of his books, and I think he called it Stephen Hawking's God or something to that nature. John Lennox, who has a triple doctorate and was professor of mathematics at Green College, Cambridge, Green College, Oxford, and is one of our colleagues on our team. So they've responded. David Berlinsky also, even though he's a naturalist, even though he's a skeptic, has responded. I would basically say three very simple things. Number one, however you section physical concrete reality, you always end up with a state of affairs that concrete reality doesn't explain its own existence. That physical concrete reality doesn't explain its own existence. Number two, wherever you see specified complexity and design, you assume a designer. Number three, looking at the history of culture, humanity, and history, you see the very person of Jesus Christ coming with the prophetic scheme and the specifics of it and all the promises contained there and his transformation in the human heart. So whether you take those three stages, however you cut down physical concrete reality, you end up with a state of affairs that it doesn't explain its own existence. Whenever you see specified complexity or design, you assume a designer. and in the human events and course of history and culture and the human search, you see, especially in the person of Jesus Christ, the evidence of God's existence. But if you take just the first two and leave the third out, it ought to lead you to wherever the evidence actually directs you. And once you accept the existence of something non-physical that is eternal and a designer, you can go into history and the human experience and see how it is that Jesus Christ indeed has changed lives, changed history, changed hearts. And in that three stages, I think you can demonstrate the reality of a personal, moral, first cause who also offers to transform the human heart. That would be my basic response. But people like Stephen, like John Polkinghorne and all in his book, One World, have done a marvelous job of explaining it. Do you have anything to add to that, Abdu?
Just something short. It would be this. The next step, though, is not just to speak to the language that someone else speaks. And if it's science, then we can talk about science. And science points to things. Now, science is a measure of the physical world. But it also leads to implications about what the world is actually like in a non-physical realm, in terms of the moralities that are around us, in terms of the meaning and the purpose for what which we were created. In fact, when you look at someone like Francis Collins, who is himself a Christian, a quite devoted Christian, who is a scientist, in fact, the leader of the Human Genome Project, and now I think the director of the National Institutes of Health, he will tell you that when you look at DNA, for example, you have the universe itself, then you have the specific design of DNA itself, 3.1 billion bits of information, specifically ordered. And we're finding more and more of the information that's actually coding for, or actually has function, the more and more we look at it. You're seeing something. You're not seeing a specific statement that says this is God created, but it is an implication that that which is ordered specifically has an informer. The information has an informer. There's an implication being made there, a leap. Not too far of a leap. In fact, when you look at Stephen Hawking's own words about the way in which the universe itself seems to be designed, that there are certain properties that if they were even infinitesimally off by a hair's breadth, you'd have no life possible in the universe in any way. And to quote, I think it was Frederick Coyle who said, Edwin Hubble, I can't remember which one of the H's, who said that it looks like somebody's been monkeying with the physics. Interesting statement. But there's another aspect to this. Once we speak about these things, then we can start talking about what the Bible actually has to say about these things. Because if the Bible is true, this might get you to theism. But how does it get you to understand if Christian theism actually holds water? Because if the Bible comports with what we find in the natural realm, if the Bible comports with what we find in the moral realm, then you see a correspondence between the two. And I'll tell you this. As someone who was not friendly in any way, shape, or form to the validity of the Bible, I remember specifically grabbing a little green Bible from a Gideon. I still have that little green Bible, going back to my apartment so I could find a contradiction in it that would finally sort of, these two guys who were coming to my door, they were trying to convert me to Christianity. I was going to knock them down finally with an objection, a contradiction they couldn't explain. And in that little green Bible, specific words, I won't go into the detail because time doesn't permit, but specific words from Luke chapter 3, verse 7, suddenly got me thinking about objective truths and whether or not I was being fair with the data. Here's the point. The Bible itself spoke to a skeptic of it. So be careful about our desire to speak with lofty arguments and closed Bibles. We can actually have that Bible. It's not going to be the primary source always, but it can be a source where we can look at it and say, now does what we've explored comport with what this Bible teaches? And if it does, now it's worthy of our belief. Great question. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. We have, we're going to take, you know, this is going to be about a 30-minute time. We appreciate the time here, but we want to tackle as many questions as we can. Again, we're going to do some more afterwards. Dr. Zacharias and Mr. Murray will be down front, but a few more questions here, please. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know
why did God put the tree in the garden to begin with? He ultimately knew what decision Adam and Eve would make. So why even put the tree there to begin with? Because it makes it just seem like we're just a big social experiment.
Let me give a shout out at first. Great question. If you understand, if you look at what the nature of God first, that's what I go to, the nature of God first. And from a Christian perspective, God is a community. There is one God who is one being, but three in his personhoods, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, eternally distinct personhoods who share one nature. Is that easy to grasp? No. Is it Is it comprehensible by finite human beings? No, but it doesn't go against our logic. So God exists in the Christian mindset as a community. He defines what love and relationship is. He eternally exists in a state of relationship. So you, as an effect, he's the cause, but you, as an effect, actually crave, desire, want, covet, and mourn the loss of relationship. It's one of the key things about human existence. And you're the effect. Shouldn't the cause reflect something about that? And in this case, in the Christian worldview, the cause, who is a triune being who exists in relationship, actually explains why you, the effect, want it so badly. Now, how does that relate to your question on the Garden of Eden? God himself is a relational being. And in order to have true relationship, instead of a wind-you-up automaton like the monkeys who clasp like this and the eyes bug out and all these things, where we just wind up and see where we go, he creates the ability for us to have a choice, an actual freedom to choose relationship. Because relationship not chosen is not really relationship at all. But relationship chosen is real. Love actually has an existence then in a real sense because love itself is vulnerable. So he creates this scenario where people can actually choose. The choice is freely given. God's foreknowledge does not necessarily mean he creates the choice that they make, but the possibility for them to make that choice. He does it so that we can have relationship. You see, the God of the Bible does not lack relationship. He never lacks it. He eternally exists in that state. So why create us? He doesn't need us for relationship. Why create you or create me to muck it up? He creates you and creates me not so that he can have relationship. He's already got it within himself in the Godhead. He creates you and creates me so that you can. It is an utterly selfless act in that sense. He utterly and selflessly creates out of an abundance of his love, out of abundance of who he is as a relational being, and that relationship requires choice and a free will that's there. And that tree allows for that. And because of that, you and I there's a fallen nature to humanity, and that's there as well. But then the redemption comes in, and then we are offered, as Ravi had already said from John 3:16, that God so loved, relational quality, the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believe, and actfully given, and actfully chosen, shall not perish but have everlasting life. From the beginning we have relationship, from eternity we have relationship, and in redemption we have relationship. And the tree actually is the beginning of that.
It's a very, very good question, sir. And I think it actually hinges a little bit also on the previous one. You know, the thing about skeptics sometimes when they ask us these questions, and I'm not saying it's you because I don't know the background from which you're coming, is oftentimes I wonder whether they realize we ask these same questions. You know, we struggle with these issues. It's not like we think these are invalid questions. They are very valid questions. But what does the question assume? The question assumes something very critical, that the answer should be coherent, because a coherent worldview is what you're really looking for. You cannot be comfortable with incoherence. And the question that was asked earlier, the whole issue of how does one talk to a Stephen Hawking? The fascinating thing about the talk that Stephen Hawking gave in 1990 at the Lady Mitchell Auditorium, which was packed, on the question of is man determined or is he free? He went through about 25 minutes of all kinds of scientific arguments and so on, and his culminating statement got an audible response of, oh my, is this the best answer we can get? And what he said at the end is, yes, we are determined. He was under the stranglehold of determinism right from the beginning in a naturalistic framework. He said, yes, we are determined, but since we do not know what is determined, we may as well not be. That was his concluding statement. Yes, we are determined, but since we don't know what is determined, we may as well not be. What he's really saying is, since we don't know the answer to my the explanation for my conclusion, let us live as if it is not a legitimate conclusion. That's really what he was saying. So I say, when you're looking for a coherent worldview, look at it this way. What options would there have been for the great creator in the beginning of this? No world at all versus this world. Okay. Number two, creating a world where there would be no such thing as good or evil, an amoral world. Number three, choosing a world where we would only choose good, where we'd be predetermined to choose good. there would be the total constraint. So we've got three options. Nothing versus what we now have. No such thing as good or evil. Or creating a constraint where we would only choose good and there were, we would never make the evil choice. Or number four, creating this kind of world where there would be the possibility of good and evil and we are given the option of the privilege of freedom and making the choice. Out of these four options, this option is the only universe and the only world in which love is possible. In the previous three, love is not possible at all. Love would not have been possible within between the divine and human interaction. So I say this, sometimes these are mega questions and macro questions, and other times they are filtered down into micro questions in the fine-tuning of an individual life. I found the answer to this, first of all, from the negative. You take a naturalistic framework, you live with an incoherent world. I couldn't live with that. So how do I find coherence? In putting together the diversity in my own heart, which was put together by God. And that knowledge of a personal relationship with God would change not only what I did, but what I wanted to do in my personal life gave me hope, meaning, and a relationship. Let me give you just two quick illustrations because I think this is critical. I've had the opportunity of speaking at one of the most famous prisons in the world, Angola Prison in Louisiana. Abdu was with me, some of my colleagues with me. 6,000 plus prisoners there, 85% of whom are in life without parole. It was the bloodiest prison in America. Blood on the ceilings, blood on the carpets, blood on the walls. When a prisoner was checked in there, he was given a dagger or a knife with which to protect himself. And this warden comes in, this director comes in and says, I'm going to change this place. You allow me to do it my way. He put a Bible in every cell. He had chapel every day. He has a seminary that he's built in there. Within a matter of a year or two, it became the safest prison in America. Today, instead of a gang of thugs, they've got gangs of pastors going through that prison out there, and they're the prisoners themselves. We had lunch with them, and I said to the guy sitting opposite us, why don't you and get yours? He said, hey man, I'm going nowhere. You may as well go and get yours, and then I'll join you. The guy who led in worship, a young man, I said to him, can I ask you a question? Because he led worship so beautifully. I said, can I ask you a question? Are you here for a life without parole? He said, yes, sir. I said, how do you feel? He said, Mrs. Zacharias, if you'd known why I am here, you would never ask me that question. He said, but let me tell you something. Out there, I thought I was free, and the horrific things that I did destroyed people's lives and destroyed my own. Now, inside prison bars, having found Christ, I have never been freer in my life. This is the most free I have ever been. Pray for my family. They're outside and think they are free when they are really not. And he put his arm around me and prayed for me. And there were tears running down my face. We had lunch made by the prisoners. The warden sits there, eats the lunch that the prisoners have made. Boy, you call that faith? You better believe it. And he does it. Why? They have found meaning by an individual life being conquered. When you know Christ, when you have that relationship, and your will is transformed to his will, you find out why you were made in the first place. And the crowd is just multiplied opportunity for individual conquest that God desires in every life out here tonight. I'll leave that with you.
Let's take a question from Twitter or text, because we are going to respond to those at some point. We do want to at least take one from there, because if you have sent something in, our promise is that we will respond to those. If not tonight, you will get something in the coming days. But let's take one. I know you all have been working. You have something on the screen from us, a Twitter or text question?
For those of us who can't read,
yeah. Go ahead.
Am I a bad person for doubting or questioning my faith? I think, you know, it's interesting. Boy, it's a good question. Doubt, it'll become a dirty word. If we say, you know, you have to believe 100%, and if you have any questions or any doubts, and you're not really a true Christian or whatever these things might be. This is interesting because let me just answer this as shortly as I possibly can. But it's terribly, terribly important because I think people often fall into despair and their doubt creates further doubt. There's a difference between two things. There's a person who's a skeptic and there's a person who's a cynic. A skeptic is somebody who doesn't believe something until there's enough evidence. A cynic is somebody who won't believe it even when there is. Two different things. Now, if you're a skeptic, I'm skeptical of a lot of things. But if you're a skeptic and you come to wrestle with these issues, doubt can often drive us to a knowledge of the truth because it drives us to find out, is this really real or am I believing in a fantasy? And doubt can help us get there. John the Baptist, the story of John the Baptist, of course, who Jesus said there was no man greater and born among women than John the Baptist, comes when he's in prison and bad things had happened to him, and he comes and brings his people to Jesus and says, are you the one who's to come, or should we look for another? This is the same one who baptized Jesus and saw the dove and all these things, yet he has his doubts. And Jesus rewards his doubts, not with saying, go away, be gone, you're a doubter, get out of here. He says, go tell John the evidence. His doubt, his sincere doubt, was rewarded with evidence. So doubt can be something that leads us to faith, a stronger faith. But if it becomes cynicism, that becomes a problem.
Good. Excellent. Next question, please.
Hi there. I was raised by a mother who was a feminist and is a questioning Christian at the moment. And she finds that there's some contradictions somewhere in the Bible that states that male have to be dominant over women, and women have to be submissive. So, just from a Christian perspective, does God favor a gender specifically?
And you know why? What I think your mother has a fair question there. I don't think it's just in a vacuum or in any sense of just trying to be cavalier about it. Not just that. You think of the very nation that he chose through whom to reveal himself. He could have chosen Rome. He could have chosen Greece. He could have chosen Babylon. In fact, William T. Ewers, talking about it in a piece of poetry, said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. But then he went on to say, how odder still are those who reject whom God chose. God, I think, oftentimes in life, for the human life, chooses the weakest through whom to make his strength manifest. If you were to ask me what really makes this world, you know, let me dispel one idea here. You often hear a statement, men are more cerebral, women are more emotional. Nothing is farther from the truth. But I'll tell you what I have found. Both are equal cerebrally. But women are more consistent in willing to let the thought be connected to the emotion. Men like to hide from the emotional ramifications of the thought. So if I talked to my mother, she'd immediately connect the emotion with what she was thinking. With my father, you could draw circles around it because he'd run from the feeling. I've talked to husband and wife. We were on a vacation once, and they had both lost a son. And the woman was talking to my wife and said, it has put such a strain on our marriage because my husband doesn't even want to talk about it while I'm breaking up on the inside. They both had the same thoughts. One was running from it. The other was willing to find the greatest bridge between in life between the head and the heart. So even in theory, the whole idea is wrong. Secondly, some of the finest thinking in the world has been done by womankind. You see it. So this myth has to be dispensed with. It's purely an archaic thing. But to your question, is the Bible dishonorable like this in gender? We've just had Joe Vitale, who is on our team from Oxford. She has just defended her doctoral dissertation at Oxford on this very issue and this very subject, demonstrating how strongly the Bible speaks of the equality of the genders and what it is God has in mind and the complementariness of the two. So here is my question to you. If God were a discriminator against gender, the greatest truth on which the gospel hangs is the resurrection. If Christ be not raised from the dead, our faith is in vain. Why in heaven's name did he reveal himself to the women to go and tell the message. All of Easter hangs on the testimony of womankind with whom he trusted the entire gospel. When the woman with the alabaster ointment came to him and those were frowning about her, he looked at them and said, "Be quiet. Wherever the gospel is preached, there shall also this be told, what this woman has done to me in worship." He paid her the greatest compliment that the gospel would be carried to the ends of the earth, and this story of this woman's faith will also be told. He goes to Samaria, and he sees a woman of the well with 5 broken, shattered marriages. She was ethnically barred from the society, as it were, maritally broken and shattered 5 times. He made her the first evangelist to the Samaritan world. Imagine what an incredibly gracious God to remind us that none of us is superior to the other. We only have the same privilege of taking our distinctives and complementary strengths and carrying the message to the world. I can tell you this, I would never be here today if it weren't for the strength of my mother. And when my younger brother was 6 or 7 years old, he was dying with double pneumonia and typhoid. My dad had given up. Our family had given up. We were living in Delhi. And the doctor came and told us, my younger brother Ramesh, who's today the chairman of the Department of Pain Management at McMaster University in Canada. He was 6 or 7, dying. I remember seeing him as a bag of bones for the last time. I'm 6 years older than him. And I walked away from there bidding him goodbye. He was unconscious. My mother refused to leave. She refused to leave. She sat by his bedside, and we were all worn to the bone, including my dad. And so 4 of us kids packed up, taken back home, and all of us lying in bed saying, "We've just lost our youngest." My mother sat by his bedside. Whatever she was doing, I don't know, and in sheer exhaustion, for days she hadn't slept, and just by his bedside crying out to God to rescue her son. Somewhere in the early hours of the morning, he began to move and began to, he was very much alive, but just quite worn out and broken. And that need of life was coming back to him. And the next day, when we all were told to come back to the hospital, his eyes were open and his whole life given fresh strength. There was only 1 out of the 6 of us there who had the strength to sit by that bedside and watch what loomed as a tragedy and watch the triumph to turn into victory. Anybody who thinks that's weak and lesser doesn't understand reality. God is the God of humankind. And the last thing Jesus said on the cross for the redemption of mankind was, look at a young man and tell him not to forget his mother, to make sure she was also taken care of because a sword was piercing through her heart. That is our Lord, who treats all of us with intrinsic worth and reflective splendor. And I thank God for the beauty he has created in this complementariness.
Thank you.
Well, let's do this. We're still going to have some time to answer questions in the back. We've got kind of a special thing. I want to make sure we cover at the end. So let's do this. Let's do one final question. Dr. Zacharias, I believe, wants to have some final words here, and then let's take a final question on this.
Hi. I was wondering, I've grown up in steeped in church traditions. I went to a religious school. I still go to a religious school. And I feel that perhaps indirectly I've been taught that the most important thing about Jesus is his death. And I was wondering how true that is.
Well, boy, without his death, there is no gospel. Without his resurrection, the death doesn't mean anything. I once gave a talk, great question, by the way. I once gave a talk at a business. I was talking about Easter at Diversity Day, because they'd never had a thing about Easter done at this particular business. And I made this statement, and I think it's true, that Christmas without Easter is meaningless. Easter without Christmas is not possible. So you see the birth and the death and the resurrection all wrapped up into the story. The story is a beginning, middle, and end. But when Jesus was asked, why have you come? He says, for this reason I have come. He's come to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the reason. Now that ransom is his death as a payment for sin, because what the gospel tells you and tells me is this. And by the way, if I can just have a short aside here. Jesus, I love Jesus for a lot of reasons. One of those reasons is he's not a salesperson who tells you what you want to hear. He tells you what you need to hear. It's a very terrible sales pitch to say, you're evil, come follow me. What kind of a poster is that? But people do it anyway. He tells you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear, in distinction to every other worldview, by the way, which tells you that you can do it yourself. You're the one who can make it on your own. And I think if the 24-hour news is one of the worst inventions of the past 20, 30 years. I got a clap over here on that one. One thing it does provide us, though, is ample evidence that man is in need of a Savior who's not himself. We need someone who's not us to save us from ourselves because of our innate innate evil and our sin. Jesus told us that 2,000 years ago. So we need someone who can redeem us, who can pay the penalty that we deserve. Jesus says, I'm that guy. Now, what's interesting is, if he died and stayed dead, then how would you know he's right? He could be dead and, well, maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong, who knows? He's like everybody else, so maybe he was wrong. But he didn't stay dead. His death is the payment. When he says on that cross, tetelestai, when he says that in the Greek, it actually means it is finished, it is accomplished. It's a financial term, paid in full. It's like a stamp on a document. The debt is paid. That is done for us. But you can know that he was right, that he took away the sins of the world through that death because of his resurrection. If he died and stayed dead, no way to know. But he didn't die and stay dead. He showed his conquering over that death, his conquering over the last enemy through the physical and, I believe, truly historical resurrection from the dead. So the death without the resurrection doesn't really show you anything, but the resurrection shows that the death meant something. In fact, let me just put it this way plainly, it meant everything. Thank you.
Some years ago, I had the privilege of speaking at the United Nations, and they had asked me to speak on a search for absolutes in a relativistic world. It's a tough subject, especially in the early hours of the morning, and you're given about 18 minutes. And what I did in my talk is talked about four absolutes that we really look for: evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. I said we all have the desire to call some nation an evil nation. You brand some nations evil nations. But you all also talk about justice. You want just societies. You all love your families and you miss your families. And then some of you are going to blow it ethically and you need to be forgiven. Evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. So I said to them, where in the world did all of these converge at one point in history? There was pin drop silence. I said they converged on a hill called Calvary. And as that meeting was over and I presented to them the message of Calvary, they were lined up, the ambassadors. And one of them came to me, shook my hand, and he said, Dr. Zacharias, he said, I come from an atheistic nation, and I don't want to be here. My president asked me to come here. I hate being here. I miss being here. But I want to say to you, today I have found out why I came here. I came here to find God. I came here to find God. Recently, I was in a Middle Eastern nation where the Minister of Finance came and asked if he could talk to me personally. Some of my colleagues know which one I'm talking about. He doesn't want to be there. So much violence. He sent his family out. And he said, I'm only here because of my faith and the sacrifice that Christ made for me, that I want to do my part in life. To take one aspect of the gospel and make it the most important aspect is actually that which God had joined together. Let no one put asunder. It is the birth, life, death, and resurrection. They are all put together. His death was spoken of, prophesied, and so was his resurrection. Even Paul struggled with that I may know him, the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his suffering, being made conformable unto his death. One thing the death of Christ does is answer for me the question of evil and pain and suffering that no other worldview offers. My colleague Vince Vitale and I wrote the book, Why Suffering? And in that I made the comment that God does not conquer in spite of the dark mystery of evil. He conquers through it. So the cross is central, but it is not in isolation, because you and I do not need a guru. We need a savior to offer and heal that which is central to your life and mine. And the Cross of Christ by John Stott is one of the most powerful books I have ever read. If you haven't read that book by John R.W. Stott, it's an all-time classic. Please take it and read it. But it fits into the grand design of God's total plan. Thank you for asking that. And now I come to this closing. Many times, as the years have gone by, and I've been in this now for 4 decades, I ask myself the question, why am I doing this? What's in it for me? Your organizers will tell you, money is not even mentioned in this when we come. I frankly don't know who is paying for what in this. We just show up. We're here. And we cover 15 to 20 countries a year. Deep in my heart, I am persuaded that outside of Jesus Christ, there is no other answer to the haunting questions of your life and mine. I say that truthfully. As book after book has been written, I have no other answers. If there were, I would give them to you. And so whether you're speaking at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow or the UN or a university or sitting next to somebody in a plane, the only answer I have seen is in the person of Jesus Christ on the 4 questions of life, of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And especially to you students, may I say this, you have a rare privilege. You have a very rare privilege. I didn't have the mind that you all do, frankly, and I'm not putting this up, but I would never have made it into a university like this. I lived for cricket. I wanted to play cricket. I was a sports person. I wanted to play cricket for India. That was my goal. I neglected my studies, never worked hard, ended up with shame on a bed of suicide. In about 2 weeks from now, I'm speaking at St. Stephen's College at the University of Delhi, probably the premier institution in the whole country of that specific nature. Anybody here from India will tell you St. Stephen's College, Delhi, most of India's students would never even get in. And yet the principal has asked me if I would come there and present a defense of the Christian faith. God has a sense of humor. I would never have made it as a student. And now they're asking me to come and speak to them. This is how God does it. Because the coherence of the Judeo-Christian worldview deals with where you are. And you have 2 options to go with. And I'll close with this and give you what I think would be a marvelous response on your part. Your tensions are great. Your allurements are great. Your physicality is a strength, but also makes you vulnerable. You are possibly oftentimes at the mercy of an academic who wants to knock God out of you. This happens again and again and again. I hear it so often. I will tell you this. You reject God and your worldview will become systemically incoherent. You follow the truth where it leads, and in the person of Christ, you will find personal meaning and the meaning that God can help you carry it to the rest of the world. Konrad Adenauer, after the Second World War, was alone with Billy Graham. Billy Graham is not very formally educated, and he will tell you that with a minimal education, God's anointed him. Konrad Adenauer looked at Billy Graham. Billy Graham told this to us around a gathering of lunch. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Graham, do you believe Jesus Christ really rose from the dead? And Graham said, Mr. Adenauer, if I didn't believe that, I would have no message left to preach to the world. He said, Konrad Adenauer walked out towards the window, looked out of that window and turned around. He said, looking at the ruins of his city, he said, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Several years ago, when I was a young man just starting my ministry living in Toronto, I was driving on the 401. It was a cold night, snowy night. I was driving in my little Volkswagen Red Bug, and I saw a guy on the side of the road thumbing for a ride on a highway. I said, somebody's going to run over him. I pulled up on the side quite late at night, about 10:30. I opened the door. I said, are you okay? He said, can you take me home, sir? I said, where do you live? And he told me it was not near my home, but I was fearful for him and fearful for myself. He was a total stranger. I said, come on in. So before he even said anything, I said, please give me your name. He said, my name is Lorne Lusthouse. I said, as we are driving, talk to me about who you are, and then I will tell you what I do. And as we were driving, he said to me, tonight's been another night. Same thing, liquor, fun, everything. He said, Ravi, I'm a messed up young guy. I'm totally messed up. He was stopping, pausing, thinking, collecting his thoughts. When I dropped him off at his home, I took his hand. I said, Lauren, I'm leaving out of town early tomorrow morning. Will you please see me when I come back next week? Here is my phone number and my address. I want to see you. I want to meet with you. He said, okay. And he took my phone number and address. When I came back, there was a letter waiting for me from Lauren Lusthouse. But when I contacted, I found out that week he had burned himself to death as well. And in my letter was this poem. I want you to think about it. Lost in a world of darkness, without a guiding light, seeking a friend to help my struggling, failing plight. So all of you good people just go on passing by, leaving me with nothing but this lonely will to die. For somewhere in this lonely world of sorrow and of woe, there's a place for me to hide, but where, I do not know. For no matter where I go, I never will escape the devil's reaching, clutching hand or the drink of fermented grape. So out of my grief and anguish, perhaps some wandering boy will see and build his own life in this world, strong and good and free. But he was gone. What a genius to be able to put those thoughts together. What if this same young man had turned that genius to the glory of God as a poet? You look at a fork in the road, and I just say to you, you don't have to take our word for it. Get the Gospel of John and say a prayer. Jesus, if you're really who you claim to be, speak to my heart and change my heart. If you are truly the Son of God, you mean that sincerely, and I'm hopeful that he will answer your prayer. And when you enter that relationship, you will become an ambassador for him as well. What an honor for me to be here at your great university and see a turnout like this. We're not worthy of a turnout of this nature, but thank you for hosting us. And if even one of you gives your life to Jesus Christ or begins your journey in that direction, we would consider worth it for having come here. Turn your heart towards the home for which God has made you and build your own life strong and good and free. God bless you and thank you.